Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
It's good to be back.
This is part three in our 10-part audio series exploring the history of Afrin.
That's right.
Today, we're looking at a really significant stretch of time, focusing on the period from the Muslim conquest of the region around 637 AD.
All the way up to the dawn of the Ottoman era in the early 16th century. So a long span.
Nearly nine centuries of transition and, well, change.
And using the source material you've provided, our goal is really to understand how this pivotal historical shift impacted the region, its key places, and, you know, the people who lived there during these long centuries.
Yeah.
We've got articles and research excerpts here that hopefully paint a picture of Afrin during this specific era.
Okay, let's jump into this period then, starting with that major turning point, the Muslim conquest around 637 AD.
Right.
What do the sources tell us about how this unfolded in the Afrin area specifically?
Well, it wasn't necessarily one single instantaneous event across the whole region.
Hmm.
The sources indicate that forces under commanders like Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Lada and Iyad ibn Gam.
Okay.
They moved through the area and secured key locations.
So they integrated it into the larger new order being established. And this included important historical sites. Right?
Precisely.
Yeah.
The ancient city of Cyrus, which we've, you know, discussed before, was one of these.
Ah, yes.
After the conquest, it became known by its Arab name, Quarus. The important Juma Plain was also secured.
Right.
The region was then organized and integrated into the administrator district, or Jund of Kinasrin.
The Jund of Kinasrin. Okay. And what was that early period like under this new Islamic administration? Was it chaotic initially?
Actually, the sources suggest that the immediate aftermath of the conquest during the early Islamic period and the Umayyad Caliphate, which lasted until around 750 AD.
Okay.
That period was relatively stable, actually.
Hmm. Interesting. And here's where we see an interesting detail pop up in the sources about population movements. During that Umayyad period, around 707 AD, there's a mention of a resettlement.
Yes, this is a fascinating detail the sources give us. It sort of speaks to how the new rulers were managing the territories.
Uh-huh.
There's a report of people known as the Jarajima being resettled from the area of Marash, which is further north,
right,
onto Mount Lelin, also known as Jabal Semen, and the nearby Hawar Mountain.
Why is that detail significant for understanding this period in Afrin? What does it tell us?
Well, it tells us a couple of things, I think. First, that Mount Semen continued to be a suitable and likely inhabited area for settlement even after the conquest.
Right.
And second, that the administration was actively relocating populations, sometimes bringing in distinct groups like these Jarajima and integrating them into specific parts of the region.
Okay, so initial integration and some population management. What happens as we move further into this long period, say from the mid-8th century towards the 12th century? This region is right on a frontier, isn't it, between empires?
Absolutely. You've hit on a key point. The sources show that Afrin didn't exist in isolation during these centuries. Not at all.
Right.
It was frequently caught in larger conflicts, situated right between the Byzantine Empire to the north and various Muslim dynasties emerging closer to Aleppo, like the Hampton Inns.
So it became a contested space, a bit of a buffer zone, maybe.
Exactly. Caught in the middle sometimes.
Yeah.
The sources provide specific examples. Kalat Semen, the site of the famous St. Simeon complex,
yes,
which had been fortified over time, is mentioned as being damaged and even temporarily captured by Byzantine forces in 983 AD.
Wow. Okay.
So that really highlights how fluid the imperial borders could be. And, well, that conflict was a recurring reality for the people there.
Now, alongside these interactions with larger empires, this era, particularly from the 10th to the 12th centuries, also sees the rise of notable Kurdish dynasties in the broader region. What do the sources reveal about their significance?
This is where we see a different kind of regional dynamism emerging.
Hmm.
It's quite interesting. The sources mention entities like the Anisids, Marwanids, Shadidids, and Hasanwayhides.
Right. Those names come up.
And these weren't just isolated groups. They demonstrated, you know, real political capacity and military prowess.
Mm-hmm.
They were interacting with larger powers of the time, like the Bides and the emerging Seljuk Turks.
What's fascinating here, as you say, is that these groups showed a capacity for, like, state building in their historical homelands.
They really did. The sources indicate they could establish functioning administrations, sometimes even minting their own coins or fostering cultural centers.
Mm.
It gives us a picture of significant political activity in the region before the major empires fully consolidated control later on.
And this is the context into which figures like Saladin emerge, isn't it? Sort of the backdrop.
Precisely. The sources mentioned Salah ad-Din Yusuf ibn Ayyub Saladin, who rose to prominence in the late 12th century.
A huge figure, obviously.
Absolutely. And he hails from a prominent Kurdish family, the Roadiya tribe, with historical roots near Devin. Now, while his ultimate reach was across a vast empire,
yes,
his origins and the context of these earlier Kurdish dynasties place Afrin within a regional sphere that definitely had a history of Kurdish political activity and influence, particularly looking towards areas north and east of Aleppo.
Okay, moving on to another fascinating aspect the sources highlight, the transformation of historical sites during the Islamic period, especially as we get into the later centuries under the Mamluk Sultanate. That's around the 13th to 15th centuries.
Correct. And Nabihuri, the site of ancient Cyrus, provides a remarkable illustration of this sort of layering of history.
You're talking about that Roman hexagonal tower tomb, the one that's quite distinctive.
Exactly that one. The sources detail how this ancient Roman structure underwent a really significant change in function. In 1303 AD, during the Mamluk Sultanate, this Roman tomb was repurposed.
Repurposed as what? A shrine.
Yes, precisely. Mm. As a mausoleum dedicated to a figure known locally as Nebihuri.
Nebihuri.
Identified in local tradition as a Sufi saint, the lower level of the original Roman structure became identified as his burial place.
Ah, okay.
And the adjacent Roman cemetery began to be used for Muslim burials. So a complete shift in use.
So the structure itself and the surrounding area were given a completely new religious meaning and function.
That's right. And the sources note that shortly after, in 1314 AD, Ala ad-Din ibn Altınbuğa, who was the Mamluk governor of Aleppo at the time,
right,
he commissioned the construction of a mosque right next door to this newly consecrated shrine.
Wow. That really cements its new identity, doesn't it? Placing a mosque right there.
It absolutely does. The sources show this later veneration of the medieval mausoleum revived Nabihuri's role as a local Muslim pilgrimage site. It demonstrates a clear continuity of significance for this ancient location, but with a profound transformation in its religious identity and architectural use under Mamluk rule.
So it remained important, just differently.
Exactly. And it's worth noting, Muslim travels in the 13th and 14th centuries still described Cyrus, or Korosh as they called it, as a substantial city, even if partially ruined, which indicates its continued importance, albeit evolving right through this later phase of the period we're discussing.
Okay. As we approach the end of this long historical sweep towards the early 16th century and the transition to Ottoman rule, what can we gather from the sources about the region's economy and society? What was life like then?
Well, while detailed accounts covering the entire 637 to 1517 period are, let's say, sparse regarding daily life across the board.
Yeah, that's often the case.
It is.
Yeah.
But the records we do have, particularly those looking toward the early Ottoman period, just after our time frame, give us a clear picture of the region's character at the close of the Mamluk era.
Okay. And what do those later sources describe?
They describe the region, often referred to as Kurd-Da, the mountain of the Kurds,
right,
as having an economy deeply tied to its geography.
Hmm.
Agriculture and animal husbandry were absolutely vital.
Makes sense for the terrain.
Definitely. Olive cultivation in particular is noted as being very prominent in later accounts. We hear a lot about olives.
So a rural resource-based economy, fundamentally.
Yes. And it was oriented towards regional markets. The sources mention centers like Keeley's in Aleppo serving as outlets for these agricultural and pastoral products.
So connected to the wider economy. And the people? What about the social structure on the ground?
Interestingly, sources like the 16th century Ottoman records, the Tahrir Defters, which are tax registers, basically.
Yes, very useful sources.
Extremely. They reveal the existence of nomadic and semi-nomadic Kurdish tribes in the area since at least that time, right on the cusp of this transition we're talking about.
Okay.
Furthermore, the sources describe how from around 1527, so just after our period technically ends, but reflecting the situation of the transition.
Understood.
The Kurd-Da area was administered under a system that granted hereditary administrative rights to a powerful local family, the Kanpolatu Salari, also known as Janbalad.
A local dynasty, essentially, holding administrative power.
Effectively, yes.
Yeah.
With hereditary rights granted by the Ottomans, likely building on existing influence. And the sources identify Sindiris as the central village for them.
Oh, dears. Okay.
So this points to a degree of localized control rooted in the existing social structure that persisted and was even utilized as the Mamluk era ended and the Ottoman era began. Local power structures were clearly very important.
And that brings us right to the significant political shift that closes out this period, the transition to Ottoman rule itself.
Yeah, the final act of this particular historical chapter. The sources pinpoint a decisive event.
Yeah.
The Battle of Marj Dabiq. Which took place in 1517, just south of Aleppo.
And this was between the Ottoman and Mamluk armies, correct? The two major powers.
Exactly. The Ottomans under Sultan Selim I versus the Mamluks.
And the outcome?
A comprehensive Ottoman victory. It really paved the way for Sultan Selim Arsir to enter Aleppo almost immediately.
And that moment marked the end of Mamluk control over northern Syria, including the Afrin region, right?
It did. This event decisively brought Afrin and the whole area into the vast and expanding Ottoman Empire. It marks the clear endpoint of the specific centuries, 637 to 1517, that we've been exploring today.
So nearly 900 years. When we look back, what does this all tell us about Afrin during this incredibly long span, from the Muslim conquest to the early 1500s? What are the key takeaways?
Well, I think it reveals a region consistently integrated into larger administrative systems, yes, but also frequently caught in the cross currents of regional power struggles.
Yeah.
You know, initially under the Jund of Kenasserin, then navigating conflicts with the Byzantines and interactions with local Muslim and Kurdish dynasties like the Hamdanids and those various principalities we discussed. It wasn't static.
And we saw how significant ancient sites like Siris at Nabi Hori weren't just abandoned, but actively transformed.
Exactly. Layering new Islamic shrines and mosques onto earlier Roman structures, showing this really deep continuity of place alongside, obviously, changing identity and use over centuries.
That layering is so visible there.
It really is. And the sources give us glimpses, especially towards the end of this period, of a distinct regional economy based on agriculture, pastoralism. Olives.
The olives, yes.
Connected to important regional centers like Aleppo and Kilis, mm-hmm. and shaped by local social structures and powerful families like the Campola Tozzolari, who clearly played a role even as empires changed hands.
So this history shows a region with its own enduring character, wouldn't you say? Adapting to successive imperial rules and regional dynamics while maintaining elements of its local identity, its key sites, and its economic base.
I think that's a fair summary. It certainly wasn't just passively receiving history. It was actively part of it, adapting and shaping its own path within these larger frameworks.
Which perhaps raises an important question for you, our listener, to think about. How did these many centuries of transition, this constant regional interaction, and this layering of history we've talked about, both imperial and local, how did all that shape the foundations of identity, local power, and the way of life that would continue and evolve under the long period of Ottoman rule that followed?
It's certainly something to consider as you reflect on this particular segment of Afrin's very long and complex history. A foundation was definitely laid during these centuries.